rid of a large number of the sins of a radio that doesn't give you quite the performance that you want. To dig into the radio and start putting in higher performance transistors, you got to be careful with that one. I've gone down that road, and I've gotten myself in trouble. If you're doing it as a science experiment, you don't absolutely have to guarantee the radio is going to work again, go ahead and experiment. But if you're fairly sure you want to continue using that radio, and if its only problem is that it doesn't have a low enough noise figure or enough gain, and you can put a preamp in front of it to correct all that, that would be a hell of a lot easier approach, in my opinion. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Yes, I agree, Dick, because if he went on eBay, he could get a nice little preamp for almost, for a few dollars. I've seen them $20-$30. They're excellent. So even cheaper, you could probably get it. So I don't know what band he's looking at, but rather than do that to the radio, yeah, I agree, I would try that too. Okay, that's about it from the mailbag. Let's go on to Paul and see what he's got for us. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, here comes the space report. And Paul, there is this country called India that on their very first attempt to send a spacecraft to the planet of Mars using the knowledge they gained from other countries that have done it first, and they did it nice and carefully themselves, and they did it on the cheap. They were successful the very first time. I think that's the only country that's ever done that. Yeah, we did a flyby with Mariner, but when it comes to the first few times we wanted to go to Mars, I think it was a hell of a lot more difficult than first meets the eye. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, this is WS2N. Yeah, the first couple that we launched never got out of Earth orbit, you know. It was too early on, in 1961 or 2 or something like that. I think the first successful one was 64, was Mariner 4. And the Russians were doing it in the 60s, and early 60s. And they were failing left and right. They must have had 10, 15 of them go down. Maybe not make it even out of Earth orbit. A lot of trouble. And then when you get out there, some of them were lost. Never heard from them again, you know. But now things are getting better. What is it? 1/9 of the cost of MAVEN that we just put into orbit around Mars. They succeeded. It doesn't have as many investigating pieces of equipment on board. We probably have, 8, 9, or 10, and I think that thing's got 3 or 4 or something. But, very successful. Not a flyby, you know, they went right into orbit, so congratulations to that group. They call that the MOM, Mars Orbital Mission. They did have their own name, you know, Indian name for basically the same thing. But it was really known as the MOM Mission. So, yeah, things worked out for them. We're way ahead. We have Mars rovers driving around. The announcement that they finally made it to the foothills of Mount Sharp and they're ready to go. So this week I can confirm that they drilled a hole into the base of Mount Sharp, and now the next step is to put it into there. Take the material that's sitting in the robotic arm and put it into the test bed on the aboard Curiosity and to analyze it. So that'll be the first test out of the mountain. They've run tests before. They've tried out their drill before. Very successful. But the main goal was to get to Mount Sharp, and they've done that. It's a 3.5 mile high mountain, so they'll probably find different ways to try to get up it little by little. And the higher they go, they'll get different materials. They'll be able to tell what went on. The higher you go, the years start to change. Right now, they're at the lowest point. The eons will come closer to the real time as they go higher in altitude. So that's where we are with our Mars missions. European Space Agency, when they first did it, they say it was a failure, but I don't think so. The first time they sent something out to Mars was the Mars Express, and with it was the Beagle 2, and that was a rover. So that went down to the planet's surface and didn't succeed. But the Mars Express did, and that's a very good orbiter. They've gotten a lot of real good science from it. And in fact, they've used it as a backup for our spacecraft that are riding around on, or you know, the rovers. In fact, they used it for Mars Curiosity when it came in. All three were active. The European Mars Express, and we had Mars Global Surveyor at the time, and Mars Odyssey, and then actually four, because we had and still have Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. A lot of things flying around Mars right now, with more to come. I did want to mention the Dawn spacecraft, only because it's the anniversary of the launch of that spacecraft from Florida 7 years ago today. And that thing has been very successful. That's the one with the ion engine. People like ion engines. And it passed Mars back in about a year or so after launch. And then after that, 2011, it went on to Cirrus. Visit the Earth. Got two asteroids it's going to visit. It went to Vista, orbited that, and then broke orbit with its ion engines about a year later. And then now it's on the way to Cirrus, another big asteroid. And that will go into orbit, let's see, 2015. I think that would be next year, next summer. Maybe, I think a little earlier, probably around April of next year. They did have a problem with Dawn a couple of weeks ago. Due to solar activity, it knocked out one of the control boxes that operate one of the ion engines. So that failed for about 4 or 5 days before they could do a workaround. What they did is they fired up one of the other ion engines and brought that back to life. And they said by the end of the year they should figure out a way to figure out a bypass to this control box that failed controlling the other ion engine. There's three ion engines on board Dawn, and they don't use them all three at the same time, one at a time. So, and they're always on. These things are continuously operating year after year. They're amazing pieces of equipment. So that's pretty much it for the Dawn mission. Last week we had a space launch from Russia, launching one American and two Russians to the space station. One of the Russians was a female Russian. That would be after all this time, the first female Russian that will participate on ISS. A lot of all the other women that have gone up there, mostly Americans, and also our European Space Agency participants. But that thing got up there successfully. One of the on the Soyuz spacecraft, but one of the solar panels didn't open. That was kind of unusual, but it didn't affect anything. It docked with the space station with the one panel open. It didn't change the power output that they needed. They were worried about it actually blocking one of the heat radiators. They said all was okay on board. It was only a 6-hour flight to the station. They don't fly for days on end, two or three days to dock to the space station anymore. They just launch right up there and do four orbits and dock, drop it. And that's the the main things I wanted to mention, a couple missions coming up next year we know about. One that we really don't talk much about is the OSIRIS-REx mission. That's a planned mission to be launched next, well, actually, it's going to be launched 2 years from now, 2016. And that's going to go to an asteroid and not land on the asteroid, but to get real close where it's going to go down with like an arm and get some material off the asteroid, put it back into this astro-type shell. And when it gets near Earth again, it's going to separate from the spacecraft, similar to what Stardust did many years ago. That went out to a comet. This one's going to a asteroid, but instead of using this catch-and-miss with the aerogel, which, you know, sucked up the whatever was coming off the comet, this thing's going to touch the asteroid and get some material and bring it back, maybe a couple ounces, maybe 2 or 3 pounds, up to 4 pounds. So we'll see what happens. That's the OSIRIS-REx mission. There's more stuff. There's so much stuff going on, Dick, but I'll try to keep it to that. Back to that. WS2M.
The amount of thrust they get out of those, each one of those three ion engines on Dawn, do you know the approximate number, Paul?
One time I did. I forgot the thrust. Last time I remember it was written in the Newton form. 72 grams, 72 kilograms of xenon. That's the fuel xenon gas. It gets atomized. So that's what they use. And again, like I said, one engine at a time is five. Back to you, Dick.
If you had to make a guess, what would you guess? Roughly 1 ounce of thrust or a fraction of an ounce?
Yeah, probably. You know, maybe not even an ounce, which is very, very little. I think they say a couple of grams per square meter. I don't know whatever that transfers into newtons, but very, very low.
Does somebody trying to make a call? There is a net in progress. The tech net is in progress. Go ahead.
I would ignore that. This is WS2N. A lot of things going on. SpaceX is still involved with their manned missions coming up. Probably within 2 years. That, like I mentioned, I think a week or two ago, that they were selected for their spacecraft to be developed, and they're going to be paid all kinds of megabucks, a couple of billion dollars by NASA, and Boeing too with their spacecraft, the CST-100. But now, just the other day, Sierra Nevada, they were developing the Dream Chaser. Now they're putting out a formal complaint, unusual for them. They've been in the space business probably for 25 years, in business probably for 50 years. And they say it's unusual for them, but they're putting a complaint and they feel they should have got a piece of the pie. Back to you, Dick.
Who was that? What was the brand name that should have gotten a piece of the pie?
Sierra Nevada is the name of the company. And, they're the ones that have been developing Dream Chaser. That's the, it's a lifting body style. It's very small compared to a space shuttle. But, you know, I mean, you can put seven people on board. But this thing has been in development for many years. They planned on first launching an unmanned test flight. Probably in the beginning of 2016. I don't think that's going to happen. They just laid a bunch of people off now, so because of this contract deal.
New Horizons, I believe, is the name of the spacecraft that's heading for Pluto. And I think it encounters Pluto in close to the July 4th weekend of the year 2015. Is that true, Paul? And I would guess as it gets closer to Pluto, they're going to start turning on the cameras and other instruments and start making measurements. Back to you on that one, Paul.
Yeah, I think it's the first or second week of July of next year. And yeah, there were three spacecraft chosen at the time. The Frontier mission, whatever they, you know, they always have these names. And the three of them that were chosen was, one of them was New Horizons, and the other one was the other one I just mentioned at the beginning of the night, OSIRIS-REx, which is planning to go out to the asteroid Beano and to bring material back. And then the third one of that group, it was the Juno mission, and Juno is the one going to Jupiter. That's going to go into a polar orbit around Jupiter. So, but yeah, that's the next one that we'll be following, unmanned mission anyway, that we'll be following. This first test of the Orion vehicle is coming up in December, and that will be unmanned exploration flight number one, EF-1 they call that, and that'll be, you know, that'll be on the news. That's a manned spacecraft. You'll definitely see that on the news, especially the way it's going to be launched on a Delta IV Heavy. It's like taking three Delta IV rockets and putting them together, plus it's got a second stage to it. And, so all these things are coming up, Dick. But yeah, New Horizons is going to be very exciting. I want to see what Pluto looks like.
When it comes to really blue sky space projects, one of them was the space elevator. And I'm led to believe that that one's going to be on the shelf for some time to come, waiting for the development of graphene-like materials. Can you imagine trying to build ribbons of graphene that are many thousands of miles long, all stitched together just right? On top of that, you got to solve the problem of what happens if a hurricane or a tornado comes along in the vicinity of your space elevator. What happens if an aircraft strikes the ribbon, and how do you establish the ribbon up there in the first place? It's a great sounding project, and just like the solar power satellites that we've been hearing about for years, I'm led to believe that both are going to be on the shelf for some time to come. Is that approximately the way you see it, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, this is WS2N. The space elevator, it's funny you mention that. They just had a big meeting of people that are involved with, you know, trying to come up with some kind of plans, how to anchor this thing to the ground. And, I mean, they know it's a long way off. There's actually people meeting on a yearly basis. You know, every year they get together. I forgot what state they met in, but they get together and they talk about this thing. And, of course, the carbon was talked about, but then now graphene is the new buzzword for. But it's written out, and now it's a ribbon. They talked about what they were talking about at the meeting is this ribbon. That's got a meter wide and 63,000 miles long. So they're going to put this car-like vehicle on there and then drive it using laser beams, shooting laser beams from down below to power this thing. And it's going to fly up the ribbon at the speed of, what they say, the speed of a train. It's going to take days and days and days to get this thing to orbit. And that's the latest I heard, Dick. Back to you.
Yeah, once that is perfected, that is going to be an extremely inexpensive way of getting things into space by comparison to what we do right now, which is to use a tremendous amount of fuel to blast a rocket. So getting things into space will be a lot easier. And there have been proposals to make the the ground mounting of that ribbon be a ship at sea. And therefore you can ship, you can move the ship around in order to correct for weather conditions or anticipated impacts with satellites or aircraft or whatever. And so the ship itself keeps the tension on the ribbon constant, even though your ship is going up and down with the waves. It's a fairly complicated engineering project as I see it. A lot of potential gain, but my goodness, you get a sudden snap in that ribbon, and a lot of megabucks goes down the tubes, if you know what I mean. And powering that with a laser, I'm having trouble believing you can focus a laser through the air accurately enough from the ground to give power to that climbing machine when it is, let's say, 40,000 miles above the Earth. Could it be nuclear powered? Many of the spacecraft you're talking about, many of these remotely piloted vehicles, these spacecraft that are going to the various planets, a significant percentage of them are radioactive thermal generators. Isn't that true, Paul? By the time you get beyond Mars, I think it's almost time to stop using solar cells. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, and yeah, as far as the lasers, I've seen them do this with, I think, different groups get together. And years ago, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 years ago, they had the news show, or maybe it was Nova, and, you know, for Channel 13, maybe one of those shows. And they showed, they were competing to see how high they can go up this 100-foot ribbon. You know, they had a crane there, and I think some of them, not all of them, I don't know how many of them were doing it, but they were, you know, using lasers and everything, trying to focus this thing on a little vehicle that was going to crawl up this test piece. So I do remember seeing that. So apparently that's one of the plans. And as far as the RTGs, the radioisotope thermoelectric generators with plutonium in them, there's so many of them. I mean, the very first one was probably Apollo 12. They left the generator on the moon. One of their packages, you know, they had these packages that they, all the Apollo spacecraft left on the moon to operate. And that had one of those. So many of them do. It started years ago when we dropped it. I think I got it. I went past Mars, Pioneers, the Voyages, the Ulysses missions of which we teamed up with the European Space Station with, that went into a polar orbit around the sun. That had to be our RTG powered. Your Mars rover now, Curiosity has it. The other two that didn't have it, Spirit and Opportunity, of course, Pathfinder, the little one was also solar. Anything, like you said, past Mars, you were in trouble because of the inverse square law. But then as the solar panels were getting better and better, European Space Agency said, you know, we could probably do this with solar panels. You know, they were going beyond Mars. They were going after the asteroids because they're looking to do what they're going to be doing in a couple of months, actually landing on an asteroid. And they built their fantastically big solar panels for the time 10 years ago when they first launched. And a lot of people were wondering if they were going to get enough power out there. And they did. They did. And it worked out very well. So NASA said to themselves, well, we have this Juno mission coming up. How are we going to power this? And it looks like the European Space Agency is doing good with their solar panels. This is going out to Jupiter, way past Mars. Let's try it because the previous one orbited Jupiter for years was Galileo. That was an RTG, as well as the one that's orbiting Saturn now, you know, the Cassini mission, also RTG. So that's what happened. You have these three gigantic panels sticking out of Juno. And I don't know, I think each one is 60 or 70 feet long. So they're supplying enough power for the Juno mission. Back to you, Dick.
What is the status of Galileo right now? Is it still operational, or has that been discontinued? Paul, go ahead.
Okay, Galileo was deorbited many years ago. They let it burn up in the Jovian atmosphere. They didn't want it to go around Jupiter endlessly on its own for the next who knows how many decades. It ran out, you know, it was running out of fuel, and before they lose the capability of controlling it, the last thing they wanted to do is have it accidentally land on one of the moons of Jupiter. They want to keep those things pristine. The Galileo spacecraft did not go through a, you know, let's call it a steam cleaning on Earth to debug it like they've done with certain landing craft, like the Viking missions. By the way, the Viking missions to Mars back in the 76 was also RTG. That's why they were able to run for one for 6 years and the other one for 8 years. So, they have to go through the sterilizing cleaning system. And Galileo didn't do that. So that's why they burned them up like that. And the same bait is going to be for Cassini when eventually that thing quits. They don't want that thing to, you know, accidentally land on Enceladus or Titan. Back to you, Dick.
Is Cassini going around Saturn? And I think you're saying that one is eventually going to be crashed into Saturn?
And I guess burnt up would be the better word. You know, they let it go into the atmosphere and it becomes part of a cloud, you know. It really never makes it to the surface of either of those two planets. And just like Galileo had a probe that went into the Jovian atmosphere when it first got there, and then sent telemetry back to Galileo, and then went back to the Earth. A lot of people forget about that probe that they used. It worked quite successful down deep into the clouds of Jupiter. And Cassini, of course, had its own lander, built by European Space Agency, that separated from Cassini and went down to Titan. I remember that one quite well, and landed and took pictures and everything. That was an amazing feat, with a big parachute and all. So yeah, they all had landers and very successful missions, both Galileo and Cassini. Although Galileo was the one that had trouble opening up their parabolic antenna, that didn't work out, so everything came back on low gain.
Galileo, low gain. So that was part of, I guess, the reason it got deorbited. I guess an awful lot of the high-resolution pictures they could have sent back if they had a bigger communication channel would have taken place. Is that a good guess, Paul?
Oh, instead of getting, you know, 100,000 pictures back, they probably just would have got a million pictures back from Galileo, you know. But the reason they deorbited was it ran out of fuel and they didn't want it wobbling around and landing on another planet. This is WS2N.
The NASA budget, is it being held steady for the last few years? Is it slowly increasing, slowly decreasing, or being held steady? What's your impression on that one, Paul?
I know for a lot of years it was going down little by little. And, you know, I think they probably get down to, what, 16, 17 billion per year or something. And out of going, I think they went up a little bit. They're hanging out in that 18 billion area. So, sounds like a lot of money when you compare that to the Defense Department, you know. And it's a drop in the water. I forgot what it was. I remember it was at the pie, you know, a little piece of pie for NASA. And here's this gigantic, probably 3% of the whole budget or something was NASA. And then you look at the budget for the defense, and then NASA's in there, you know, they're colored in there. But, if they ever put, I'd like to see them double the budget, but they won't, you know. But, take a little bit away from something and give it to NASA. You know, there's a lot of useless projects going on. Back to you, Bill.
I know you're only estimating, but if it was $18 billion per year for the NASA budget, that turns out to be $55 per American citizen. I'd be willing to spend $55 that way, wouldn't you, Paul? I think we're getting our money's worth. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's $55 for what? For the year, is that what it is? Wow. So, I thought it was a lot lower than that, actually, but that sounds kind of high, Dick. I remember talking about the cost of James Webb. I think that came out to a cup of coffee a year or something. And that was a total cost of $8 billion. And that was over a 10-year period.
That sounds about right. And if the $18 billion you estimated was the NASA current budget and roughly 325 million citizens in the United States, that would be $55 per. So I think you're saying James Webb is a cup of coffee per day. Is that approximately the way it works out?
I don't even know if it was that. I thought it was a cup of coffee a year. I forgot. I can't remember. But I'd have to do the math. But I know it's compared to, you know, everything's comparing everything to everything else. When you compare it to the defense budget, that's what, you know, you get on a computer, you look, put in defense budget pie chart for and NASA. You'll be shocked at what you say.
You said James Webb was $8 billion spread over 10 years, which is $0.8 billion per year, 325 million citizens. That's $2.46 per year. So James Webb is costing you and me $2.46 per year. And I think that's approximately the price of a real good coffee at Starbucks. Once per year, isn't that true, Paul?
Oh, I remember. It's a little low. European Space Agency is involved with that part of that budget. You know, for instance, it's going to cost you like $150 million or something like that to just launch it. Well, it's not going to cost, you know, you're not going to pay any. You know, you're not going to put your hand in your pocket at all for that, because European Space Agency is going to pay for the launch of that spacecraft. So, it's divvied up. There's other countries that are involved with putting the different parts of the test equipment. I forget how many countries are involved, but, you know, we're the lead, of course, on James Webb, but look where it's being launched from, French Guiana, on a European Space Agency Ariane 5 rocket. Back to you.
James Webb is the largest optical telescope ever to be put in space. It's going to be put in space at the Lagrange point, which I think is Lagrange point number 3. It's the one that's a million miles behind the Earth, on the opposite side from the Sun. Infrared, biggest possible mirror. It's going to see all kinds of things that have never been seen before. An ambitious mission. What a big piece of hardware that is, that all has to fold up to be launched and all carefully unfold itself in space and align itself and calibrate and whatever. At one time, I think the launch date was predicted to be 2016. Has it been pushed back to 2018? When is the predicted launch for James Webb right now, Paul? That's a good one to look forward to. You and I have got to make sure we eat lots of vegetables and get lots of exercise to make sure we're alive to see that one work. WS2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, that's 2018. And it always was. No, that hasn't changed. That stayed the same. And L2, I remember the first three real easy. First one is the closest one to the sun, so that's a million miles in the sun's direction, you know, that's L1. L2 is, you know, continue out, so that's a million miles past the Earth, and then L3 is opposite side, you know, that's opposite side of the sun, you know, completely, we don't see that one at all. And then four or five are the ones that, you know, in front and behind us. That one, I always forget that one. I think the lower number is in front of us, in front of the orbit. And the other one is behind us. And everybody has those. Any orbital thing has that. You know, you've got Lagrange points for, even for Jupiter, you know, you've got a bunch of asteroids that hang out in one section because of the Lagrange points, you know, ones in front and ones behind. Back to you, Dick.
L4 and L5 are ahead of your orbit and behind your orbit, so that the objects in that stable location of L4 and L5 make a perfectly equilateral triangle with 60 degrees on the side between, in the case of the ones with Jupiter, you draw a triangle between Sun, Jupiter, and the Lagrange point, and it's a equilateral triangle. Now, the asteroids that sit in that Lagrange point ahead and behind Jupiter, I think those particular asteroids are given a special name. Isn't that true, Ripple? K2LIW?
I thought one day the Trojan asteroids. Yeah, there is a special name to that group. I forgot. Where's Craig when I need him? I know he'd come up with that 1, 2, 3. The astronomy guy. Does the astronomy net? There is a name, but I think I had it right.
I think you hit a ball. The Trojan asteroids. I think that's the name that they were given. And so, in theory, we even have some chunks of material sitting at the Lagrange 4 and 5 points of the Earth. And there are people from time to time who think that they are contributing factors to the long-delayed echoes that we occasionally see, the echo from the material. Although that would place it exactly the same distance, let me think, as... Yes, that would place it the exact same distance as the Moon, so the echo would be 2.5 seconds delayed. I'm not sure that very many of the long-delayed echoes that people have seen on 20 meters, for instance, are 2.5 seconds. What kind of time delays have you heard of for LDEs, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, it's probably that for, especially for L5. There's a group, and they've been around for decades. They call it the L5 Society, or something like that. And it's a group that's dedicated to eventually putting a manned city located at the L5 position. Because, you know, you'd have to use very little fuel to keep it there. And they would like to see these, eventually they'd like to see wheels the size of Manhattan spinning around and all, everybody living on the outside of it, you know, with water and boats. You know, I've seen some of these drawings and pictures that they'd love to have at the L5 group. But, yeah, you'd have probably 2-second delays.
It's a fanciful dream to have a space society living in this great big tube on this great big wheel at the Lagrange point in space. Yes, you're going to get a beautiful view. You're beyond the Van Allen belt. You're beyond the Earth's magnetic field. You're not getting any of that protection. You're going to be bombarded with the solar wind, with the cosmic rays. Maintaining the air pressure in this great big tube, that's a huge engineering problem. And the big problem we keep forgetting about is that to maintain a man in space requires a lot of resources. We take that for granted, that all that air we breathe gets recycled, all the water that flows through your body gets recycled, all the solid material, the food you eat gets recycled. And to do all of that in space, to supply all of that energy and all that raw material, not easy. And those students that dream about having an astronaut living in a spacesuit on Mars, let me drop. You talk to an astronaut who spends 8 hours inside of a spacesuit with a diaper wrapped around his waist, and you describe, he describes to you what it's like and what he's got to do to recover for the next few days after a significant spacewalk. And if you think that a human being would like to live that way day in and day out for years on end on Mars, boy, I doubt it. I don't think you would volunteer for that mission, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
No, I don't think so, especially in the beginning. Like we said, there's no Burger King up there. You know, depending on what happens, eat just whatever grows. You know, I mean, sweet potatoes can eat. Skin turns color after a while. They wouldn't be too bad, you know. They wouldn't have the weightlessness anyway. What is it? Three eighths on the gravity of what you have on Earth. A little bit better than what's on the moon. Moon is 1/6. So, I mean, it's doable. But you have to be a real certain type. I'm not a big fan of this Mars One group. I keep my hands in my pocket before I'd give this guy $35 to fill out a form to see if they're going to take me. Of course they're going to take my form, you know, they're going to take your money. I kind of worry about that, you know. But I haven't seen anything there really credible come out of that. And he's going to do it by 2023 or something. I don't think so. NASA's lucky if they do it by the 2030s. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
Commander, question, actually. N1YDY. N1YDY, go right ahead with your question. And when you follow, I'm going to be asking Paul about, Virgin Atlantic is going to be launching people into space. Quite a few people are signing up for that. But YDY, you've got it, sir.
Paul, I was wondering, am I correct that Mars does not have any magnetic field? So how would any of these guys actually survive long-term up there?
You've got it.
I would say they have to get into the caves or dig on the ground or something. They're going to have temporary habitats on, you know, I mean, the plan is to put one habitat and then another one. They put them all in series. I guess eventually in parallel, you know, but for a long time you'd have to get out of the, you don't have the magnetic field, you don't have the protection that we have here. They have magnetic fields, but they're all like willy-nilly across the surface. And one of the detectors on board the spacecraft that just went into Mars a week ago, the MAVEN spacecraft has it's one of the things they're going to evaluate is the magnetic field, different ones, you know, all over Mars. They'd like to get a good handle on that, help any further landings in the future, either manned or unmanned. Back to you, I forgot your name. This is WS2N.
WS2N, here is N1YDY. Name is Hank, Hotel Alpha November Kilo. No, I was just, you know, wondering if this is a legitimate thing or if this is just a I don't want to call it a con, but basically some method of generating the revenue that it might cost to put somebody in space by getting everybody to fill out their form and send in that $35.
Yeah, you're right, Hank. I agree. I'd be very leery. In fact, the Chinese government is coming out and saying that to their people, don't send anything to them. It's only $10, by the way, for the Chinese for some reason. We gotta pay $35 or something. But there's something not right. Back to you, Dick. Very good, Hank.
Yeah, Mars is not the right place to go. It's extremely cold, extremely low on atmospheric pressure. The little atmosphere there is mostly carbon dioxide. Occasionally it gets wind that blows 250 miles an hour. It's an extremely dry, cold, low pressure, sandy, red environment. No magnetic field, no protection from cosmic rays and solar wind and solar prominences. Very hard to get to, very hard to get home from. Probably nearly 1,000 times more difficult. Let's see now. 250,000 miles is the distance to the moon. The distance to Mars at the time you'd be landing would be roughly 300 million miles. So that's approximately 1,000 times greater in distance than the moon. You probably could estimate that it's 1,000 times more expensive to get there. The Apollo mission to moon was around $32 billion in 1970 money, which is probably closer to $60 billion today, 1,000 times more than that. You'd have to have, let me drop it. To finance the mission, you'd have to have a good fraction of the gross national product of most of the developed nations on planet Earth would be required to finance that mission. So as I see it, financing it, having the right science, having the right percentage of survival, having enough reason to go there. You can send a unmanned spacecraft there that runs around on the planet for years making measurements. Yes, a human being standing there, a good geologist with a rock hammer in his hand and a magnifying glass, he can gather data 10 times faster. But it's only a million times more expensive to do it that way. I'm not sure it's a good trade-off. Am I being overly pessimistic here, Paul? And by the way, I know what your answer is going to be on that one. But when it comes to Virgin Atlantic, when it comes to where people are signing up to go into space for a brief period of time, I'm guessing a fair number of people have already signed up for that. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW.
Before you give it to him, I just want to make one comment. India managed to get to Mars on the first try for $78 million. Pretty good for their first attempt. N1YDY.
Yeah, there are ways of making it cheaper, but still, it's going to be expensive. Go ahead, Paul.
You know, and they're taking the technologies that, you know, we, Russia, China, European Space Agency, as time goes on, it's going to be less expensive. I mean, even the next Mars rover that we're sending up is going to be less expensive than Curiosity. It's like anything else. Come back 100 years from now, and that place will be developed. People will be living there on Mars. So, I don't have the time machine. We need a time machine. You asked about Virgin Atlantic. Well, they were supposed to have their first launch by the end of the year. That's not going to happen. That would be, I'm going to guess, next year. They're saying the beginning of next year. Branson himself, he wanted to go on there with his family, you know, for one of the first rides. But I think, did they say his wife was pregnant or something? I don't know. So she's out now. But he still wants to go. So that'll make the news. The only thing I don't like is they're not going into orbit. I mean, these are suborbital flights, which is fine, you know. But, you know, we all watched Alan Shepard and Brisson go up in there. And, you know, shots. Alan Chep went up on a 16-minute flight. Gus Grissom went up on a 15-minute flight. It was suborbital. But if they were doing that year after year without going into orbit, I don't think people would have paid attention anymore. The cost is kind of high. Unless you're rich. Remember they said it was starting out at, I think they said 200,000. I think they're up to 250 or something. $250,000 a ride. They're going to put 6 people in Spaceship 2 with 2 pilots, so 8 people will be in there. It's going to be carried up by the White Knight, dropped from it, and then blasted into anything over 100 kilometers, which is, you know, in space, that's a little over 60 miles. And they'll get, you know, maybe 10 minutes of floating free, and then a nice long ride back down on a runway. I mean, it's all pretty cool, but $250,000, I don't know, I would go with Lynx. That's another spacecraft. Dick, do you want me to tell you about Lynx, or am I going on and on?
Lynx is a new one to me. Give me a few words on that one. What company, and what's the price of that one, and how soon?
That'll probably be maybe the end of 2015, or the beginning of 2016. It's the Lynx spacecraft built by X-Corp. They come out of California. Now they just moved into the new spaceport in New Mexico called Spaceport America. That's where they're going to have all these commercial companies coming, you know, flying spacecraft out of. Well, Lynx is a two-person spacecraft. You sit next to the pilot, you know, you get on your spacesuit, and you blast away, you know, right from the ground. No carrier, no nothing. This thing will take you to a suborbital flight, you'll get the view and all. You're not going to get out of your seat like you will with Virgin Atlantic, float around, but you know, you'll get the same feeling. And then come on back down, and that'll be $90,000. So that's not bad, Dick, $90,000. Then I got one more that's a little cheaper.
Go ahead, Paul.
I like Paragon. It's not quite a rocket, you know. They're going to put you on this balloon, this helium balloon, this big helium balloon, and it's going to fly 6 people up to the stratosphere. I mean, you're going to get up to, you're not going to get as high as Lynx or Virgin Mobile, but you're going to be up there. And you're going to see the curvature of the Earth, and you're going to be dangling from a parasail, and the parasail is attached to this balloon, and you're in this pressurized capsule with 6 other people, and all the way up, you know, you're in there, and there you're going to have food, bathrooms there, and you know, wash your hands if you want, like a floating room, and then you get to the top, and it's going to release you. You're going to float all the way down, and you eventually land on some kind of a runway type of thing with skis on the back of this spacecraft-looking thing that you're in. Back to you, Dick. $75,000.
Paragon is predicted to fly. How soon, Paul? I presume people are signing up for all 3 of these missions, Paragon, Lynx, and Virgin Atlantic Space One. So, how soon, and are people signing up for all 3?
I don't know what Jane Point there said. I thought it was 2016. I'm not sure if it's 2015. Probably 2016, I guess. I don't think they're ready. And by the way, she's one of the people that were in the Biosphere years ago. You might remember that, Biosphere 2, where they stayed in there a couple of years and tried to duplicate a trip to Mars. But she's a regular scientist now. You know, she with she was the chief scientist for the NASA habitat, that used to fly in the back of the space shuttle, Spacehab, for the environmental controls. Back to you, Dick, WS.
Spacehab, I think, was intended to be a 2 or 3 year mission, but I vaguely remember it got cut off a shorter period of time up hole because of insufficient nutrition, oxygen. Something wasn't quite right. I thought it got cut off at a shorter period of time. Over to you, Paul.
I know the second team, they didn't last long. A couple of few months, I guess. But the first one went 2 years. So that one worked out. But I know there's some controversy involved in that. But they did a heck of a job, I think.
What accounted for that difference, Paul? How come the first team was, you think, 2 years, and the second team only a couple of months? What had changed? Were the rules of the game set slightly differently? Was the team during the 2 year mission getting some periodic supplies? Go ahead.
I'm in the middle of reading a book. I'll have to get to the end of that. Get back to you in about a week or two. I'm reading, it's called 2 Years and 20 Minutes. So, yeah, I'm sure they'll have a, basically about the first mission. The second one, I'll have to look and see what happened there. Back to you.
When it comes to real good science shows, NASA's got some really good ones. And there was this group of shows made by, I think it's an Australian guy or a British guy named Veritasium. Veritasium. You Google those words. And there's a whole series of 20-minute long YouTube videos that teach you an awful lot of very good science about space, physics, chemistry, geology, kinematics, thermodynamics, and so on. Very well done. You start looking at some of those and you'll get hooked because they're so darn well done. His premise is that when you want to teach something new to somebody and you just give them the information, in many cases they do not accept it. They do not hear it, do not accept it, and it doesn't stick with them. Let me drop. What he has discovered, apparently he's confirmed it with other organizations involved with education, that he first asked people a question. You walk up to a group of people and say, how often does the Earth rotate on its axis? Or how often does the Earth go around the sun? You know, you'd be amazed what number of people are not quite sure. What creates summer and winter? Seemingly simple questions for people like us who are involved in science. The general public, 50% of them have got a good deal of difficulty answering these questions. By asking the question first, where the person first gives his inaccurate answer, and then in a friendly manner you supply the more accurate answer, he has discovered that the educational process works a hell of a lot better if you do it in that manner. Don't just give them the answer. Have them try to derive the answer first, then show them the error in their earlier thinking. And they remember it much better, and it sticks, and the principle is better absorbed, as I see it. He's got a good philosophy, and he's making some rather high-quality stuff. I wonder if you've ever seen any of those, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW?
No, but it sounds good. Can you repeat his name again? Start with the letter V, Victor.
Yeah, it's called Veritasium. Veritasium. That's just the name of a phony object on the periodic table. Veritasium 42, he calls it. There is no object that fulfills that requirement. But he must have assembled about 50 educational programs over the last 5 years. All of a sudden, I've forgotten his name. All I got to do is go to my website here, and I'll get it real fast. I'll do that in the next 2 minutes. But it's one of the better educational sites that I know of. and definitely worth seeking. So once you see a few of those, you're going to be hooked, Paul. I'll warn you. I'll double check the spelling right now.
Okay, yeah. I won't need his name. I'll just put Veritasium.